Morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Jennifer Swigert here on behalf of the appellant, Emil Matos-Ramos. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Very well.
We ask this court to reverse Matos-Ramos' conviction because the court failed to properly instruct the jury on how to arrive at a constitutionally unanimous verdict. For the remainder of the arguments in the briefing, we will rest on the written briefing unless the court has specific questions.
Well, I have some specific questions. So
certainly.
Let's talk about accident and the application of Rule 404B to the situation. As I understand your argument from the briefing, it was an error by the court, an abuse of discretion, to admit evidence about the bruising. Because the defendant had not first made some claim. Do you have a copy of the rule in front of you, handy?
I don't have it verbatim written out in front of me, no.
Well, here's my question. I have a copy here. 404B says, obviously, that you can't admit character evidence, but A says you can't admit character evidence, but B says that evidence of other crimes, wrongs, acts, etc., is not admissible to prove the character of a person in order to show action in conformity therewith. It may, however, be admissible for other purposes, and then it delineates representative examples, the last of which is absence of mistake or accident. When all else fails, reading the rule is a good idea, and my question is, that wording does not include the argument that you are making, that there's something else that is required. And I wonder how, in light of that language, your argument should be accepted.
We have to look at the language in light of the purpose of the rule. These so-called exceptions to ER 404B are really alternate purposes other than the purpose of proving character or propensity evidence. And so in order to satisfy ER 404B, there has to be some purpose beyond simply proving the character of the person. And when we have this so-called lack of accident that's not based on a claim of conduct by the defendant, then really all you're saying is because this happened before, it was likely to have happened again because this is a bad person, because this is a person who has a criminal propensity. Without some specific testimony that this was accidental conduct by the defendant, you're really only looking at a propensity argument.
What about the statements that he made to the medics when they responded?
Well, the statements that he made when the medics responded were a little bit confused, but what it eventually gelled down to was he didn't really even see what happened. He assumed that the child must have fallen while running back into the room and colliding with the table. And when we compare that to the other cases, the state's pointed to Roth and several other cases where there was a claim that the injury simply occurred by accident, not specifically by accidental conduct by the defendant. But in all of those cases, you have, in most of them that I've reviewed, you have a very specific claim by the defendant of what exactly occurred. Whereas here we have just a claim by the defendant that, yeah, I didn't really even see what happened. This is kind of what I assumed happened based on the context.
Well, what case do you principally rely on for a clear statement that the defendant must, that there must be evidence that the defendant admits, I think this is your argument, isn't it, that the defendant admits the conduct but claims that it happened by accident?
Yes, Your Honor, and for that we would rely on the Hernandez case, where there was evidence of prior physical abuse of the murder victim, but the defendant admitted some involvement in the victim's death. But then claimed that it was that his whatever happened, whatever actually caused her death, was an accident. And we would also rely
and
on.
And does the court say, I'm looking for a specific holding, does the court say, you know, if it hadn't been for that, we wouldn't have never let this in?
No, there's not an explicit statement
to that
effect.
So it's part of the facts, but not part of the law.
Yes, I suppose you could put it that way.
So you're asking us to make a holding for the first time that hasn't been made previously in accident cases?
I haven't seen a case that specifically says that except for the one cited in the brief, Hernandez and Heeb.
But you just said that Hernandez doesn't say that as a holding. It just, it's part of the facts.
Well, the holding, Your Honor, is generally construed as to be the facts combined with the result. And so those were the facts in Hernandez, and then that is the result, was that the evidence was admissible.
No, I don't think the law works that way. There's all kinds of facts in cases, but the court rests its decisions explicitly on certain facts and or the absence thereof in making a holding. And so I'm wondering if you have any case where that occurs or whether you're basically asking us to develop a new rule here.
I don't think it's a new rule so much as an extension and an explication of the rule that already exists. When we go back to the
and
purposes
of... where do you find that?
I mean, from the purposes
I'm looking for exact words in a case that we could hang our hat on.
I don't have that for you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
All I have is the purposes of ER 404B, that there needs to be something beyond a mere propensity. And when all we have is an accident happened before, an accident happened this time, and there from that we're going to assume that the defendant has guilty character.
If that were true, wouldn't that rule out the admission of evidence that was approved by this court in State versus Roth and in State versus Fernandez?
Well, I think that's, in Roth and Fernandez, that's where I would go back to. There you had a much more specific claim by the defendant of specifically what happened. In Roth, the defendant was on a boat with his wife, and he described in great detail the story of what happened when his wife was swimming and had a cramp, and the raft that he tried to use to help her flipped over on top of her. And so,
well, it may be more detailed, but how is that really different in kind from here, the defendant, I guess, saying, did he testify or not?
I can't remember if it was his testimony, if it was his statement that was admitted later.
I didn't see what happened. My back was turned, and I heard the kid running, and the next thing I know, a crash, and the next thing I know, he's in pain.
Well, it's very different when the defendant really claims this was what happened, and then it's very similar to things that happened in the past. Roth's former wife had also died under mysterious accidental circumstances that he also claimed to have this very specific knowledge of. And that's not what we have here. He didn't claim to have this specific knowledge. So there's not something specific by him that we're rebutting with this evidence.
But it is undisputed, isn't it, that the bruising, in other words, the Norlin test, that in other words there has to be a preponderance of the evidence that he actually caused or was involved in the incidents where the bruising occurred. Isn't that right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you repeat the question?
Okay, well, no, I mean, in other words, in this case, the prior incidents that came in, the bruising,
yes.
Was there any dispute about whether he caused those incidents?
I don't believe there was. I believe that the only testimony that was presented was from the child that this was...
Right, so the Norlin test was satisfied, connecting the defendant to the prior injuries.
Yes, Your Honor, if that's all that's required, that was satisfied, yes.
But you're saying there's something more.
There has to be some link other than propensity, and when there's no claim by the defendant specific to his conduct in this case, then really what we're looking at is a propensity argument. And so we would ask that Mr. Matos Ramos' conviction be reversed. Thank you.
When you come back, you, I take it, want to talk about the court's failure to give an instruction that was not requested below.
I would.
So I want to know about the threshold question about whether you can raise that now on appeal, given State versus Lynn and the other authorities.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Excuse me. May it please the Court, Ann Summers on behalf of the State of Washington. I will focus on the 404B issue. The cases cited by the defense do not support the proposition that in order to fall within the lack of accident exception to 404B, the defendant has to admit that he caused the claimed accident. In fact, Fernandez, Roth, and Norlin all stand for the proposition that the lack of accident exception is relevant and can be used to admit prior acts when the defense theory is that he had no role in Roth and Fernandez, they were murders. In Norlin, it was an injury. So here, the defendant claimed that the transverse fracture of this 4-year-old's thigh bone was caused by the child simply tripping and falling. And that was a claim of accidental injury. And so the state was entitled to rebut that claim. Evidence that the defendant had recently injured that same victim in disciplining him in what was characterized in the briefs, an overzealous way, was relevant to support the victim's testimony that he didn't simply trip and fall. He was being disciplined by this man in a very physically aggressive and reckless way, which caused the fracture.
Is it fair to say that Norlin discussed what is necessary for purposes of bringing in prior acts under the accident exception, but it did not squarely address what is being claimed here now?
That's right. The main issue in Norlin was whether the prior act had to be specifically tied to the defendant.
Right.
And, of course, that's not an issue here because the victim clearly said that these injuries had been caused by the defendant.
So what we need to do is look at those other cases in order to make a determination whether this additional requirement is also part of what is required. In other words,
the additional, there's no support that there's all kinds of ways accident could be claimed, right? There's a broad spectrum of facts, and so, but clearly, the main claim here was not that the fracture didn't occur, which obviously would have been a ridiculous defense, but that what happened to the child was an accident caused by the child.
So, what are you relying? You're relying on the statements that were admitted. That were made when the medics responded?
Yes.
Okay, and we've heard from counsel that those were somewhat muddled and contradictory. What's your position on what the record shows about those statements and how those constituted a defense or claim of accident?
Well, it's interesting because a lot of these cases have that kind of same factual scenario. Often, defenses are not as clear-cut as we might like them to be. For example, if you look at the case that they tried to rely on, Hernandez, the defense's account of what happened in Hernandez was just as muddled, if not more muddled. Basically, it was that the victim kind of got drunk and apparently shot herself in the chest because what he told he did not never admitted firing the gun, and he said he was in the other room when the gun went off.
So you're arguing this is the facts in this case are analogous to Fernandez, but
Hernandez. Yes.
But what are the statements in this case that support your position that the claim was an accident?
Well, there's only two possibilities: either the defendant caused the fracture, or the victim suffered some sort of injury that had to be accidental, because there was only two people at home at the time.
Well, again, you're not answering the question, which is, what were the statements?
So the statements are what he made to the first responders, as well as the statements that the implication of the statements that were made to the mother on the phone.
He being that little boy?
Yeah, who was being coached by the defendant at the time during that call.
And what were those?
I mean, that tripped and fell and hit the table somehow, and somehow that caused this fracture. Now, even if
it's the statements of the child that serves as a springboard for what you're saying, is that what you're?
Well, right? Both. It's okay. The entire.
But let's
the child's statement is what he was supposed to say.
Right.
The defendant's kind of vague statements that he tripped and it happened and he fell, and then what was said to the mother when they called right away.
Okay, so
her understanding of what had happened, which was based on statements both the defendant and the victim made to her while the defendant was coaching the victim as to how this injury occurred.
So you're relying on all of that for
all
purposes?
Of that.
Okay.
So in other words, that is what underpins the defense theory as articulated how? In closing argument or?
Yes. Okay. So even if this.
So what did the defendant argue in closing?
I can't recall.
Wasn't it that this all happened behind him while he was sitting watching, playing games or something, that the accident happened behind him? I mean, wasn't that the
essence of it? There was one point he said he was playing a video game and he heard him trip and fall.
Okay.
They offered some 404B evidence that this child had behavioral problems and was a little bit hyper and was the sort of person that was prone to injury. So that clearly fed into the accident, right? I mean, none of their 404B evidence would have been admissible had the claim not been that the victim accidentally injured himself. Now, it would also be harmless error because, frankly, the most important testimony here was the expert testimony, that this is simply not the sort of it's a transverse fracture of one of the largest bones in the body. It requires a lot of force to create this sort of fracture. The testimony was that even if the victim had fell from a height of 4 feet, this sort of fracture wouldn't have been.
Was it the state's theory that the transverse fracture was caused by the little boy actually being kicked, or by him being kicked and then rolling into the table, and the table caused the fracture? I mean, was it the collision with the foot or the collision with the table?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure we could pin that down. The theory was that there's no way this sort of fracture, which again, you know, is perpendicular to the axis of the bone, it's a very serious fracture that requires a fair amount of force, could have simply happened by the child falling.
We also have testimony of the child made to the treatment providers.
Yes. So, yes, you have the expert testimony. You have the defendant. Also, I think a big part of this is the defendant's inadequate explanation for how this injury could have otherwise occurred. His vague, his inability to come up with any sort of coherent story as to how this very serious injury occurred, and then the victim's own testimony about being kicked by the defendant. I wasn't planning on addressing anything else except for the extent I will say that the defense never requested a different instruction on the scope of deliberations. And this issue can't be raised for the first time on appeal. There certainly is no manifest error. They try to rely on Lamar, but Lamar was a very different case where they actually replaced a juror without telling the jury to begin deliberations anew. Indeed, implicit in Lamar is that the initial instructions to the jury, which were the same as the instructions here, to the initially constituted jury, was perfectly fine. So,
quite apart from whether it was preserved, what do you think of the instruction? Anything wrong with it?
I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I think the jury's told they have to discuss the case with each other, and they all have to agree on the result. And I don't think you need to be instructed further as to how to micromanage all the logistics of the jury room.
I mean, this is new to me. I've never seen this particular argument before. I'm just wondering if this is a new wave in instructions that has come from somewhere, and people are saying, yeah, it's important to do this.
It's new to me. I think it's coming out of an overreading of language in Lamar. But notably, I don't think they've pointed to any other instructions from other jurisdictions that are really explicit to the jury as to what they're supposed to do when somebody has to go to the bathroom or something like that. So the state would ask that you affirm.
Thank you.
Your Honor, the reason why this instruction is required is because of case law dating back to 1979 in State v. Fish, talking about how jury deliberations must be the common experience of all the jurors. Nothing in the instructions tells the jury that. Constitutional unanimity requires more than just a unanimous vote, and there's no reason why a juror walking in off the street would know that. And merely the instruction that you deliberate together doesn't tell them that they have to stop deliberating every time they're not together, and that the entire deliberations have to be a collective experience of all 12 jurors.
Is there anything in the record to suggest that we have anything other than 12 jurors deliberating together?
No, Your Honor, but I would refer to State v. Ashcroft, State v. Lamar, and State v. Blancaflor, all of which talk about the court inquired whether there's a reasonable possibility here that the deliberations were not entirely, that unanimity was not preserved. They didn't talk about this aspect of unanimity, but the question is whether it's apparent from the record and whether there's a reasonable possibility that unanimity was not preserved. And
this just seems to come out of nowhere. Why not go the normal route? Why don't you correspond with your colleagues in the trial defense bar and ask them to propose the instruction and either get it approved or not approved at the trial level, and then we can argue about it on a record? This is just, you know, I mean, there's a million things you could, you know, we could be here all night with appeals saying, gosh, it would have been nice if there had been an instruction that would have nailed this down a little bit more, but, you know, wasn't offered, no facts. I just don't understand why this pops up all of a sudden. It just seems like filler.
Well, I don't believe it's filler. I do believe there are other avenues that can be used to prevent this from being a systemic problem in the future, but that doesn't help Mr. Matos-Ramos. And so that's why it's being raised in this case, because it is a basis to question whether he actually received his constitutional right to a fully unanimous jury verdict. So we would ask the court to reverse.
Thank you.
Thank you.